Hey, everybody. It's Lisa Desjardins, correspondent for the PBS NewsHour. I want to let you know about a special podcast episode all about the coronavirus. It's where we answer questions like, how did we get here?
We spent billions of dollars hunting down terrorist cells, listening to people's phone calls. And we don't do that with pandemics.
And what do we do now?
If we want to be able to measure how big a problem the novel coronavirus is in this country, we have to be able to have enough diagnostic tests so that you can see where it is, when it is, and be able to respond adequately.
To listen, head over to the PBS NewsHour full show podcast feed in Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts.
This edition for Sunday, March 22nd, the latest developments on the coronavirus outbreak. In our signature segment, social services adapt to continue to provide for seniors and the psychological tolls of social distancing. Next on PBS NewsHour Weekend.
PBS NewsHour Weekend is made possible by Bernard and Irene Schwartz, Sue and Edgar Wackenheim III, the Cheryl and Philip Milstein family, Rosalind P. Walter, Barbara Hope Zuckerberg, Charles Rosenblum. We try to live in the moment to not miss what's right in front of us. At Mutual of America, we believe taking care of tomorrow can help you make the most of today. Mutual of America Financial Group, retirement services and investments.
Consumer Cellular offers no-contract wireless plans that are designed to help you do more of the things you enjoy. Whether you're a talker, texter, browser, photographer, or a bit of everything, our U.S.-based customer service team is here to find a plan that fits you. To learn more, go to consumercellular.tv.
Additional support has been provided by and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and by contributions to your PBS station from viewers like you. Thank you.
Good evening and thanks for joining us. We are bringing you our broadcast again tonight from remote locations. I'm not in the Tisch studios. I'm at home. And because we all need a sense of continuity and normalcy, let me change that blank wall to something a little more familiar. Our reporters, producers, and editors are also working from their homes and gathering the news when it's safe to do so. So let's get started with today's top news. More testing sites opened today. Some had to close quickly when demand overwhelmed supplies. Dr. Anthony Fauci of the National Institutes of Health said more and faster test kits are on the way and that hard-hit areas are a priority.
And the situation is now that the resources that are being marshaled are going to be clearly directed to those hot spots that need it most. And clearly that's California, Washington State, and obviously New York is the most hard hit. We're going to get hit. There's no doubt about it. We see it in New York. New York is terribly suffering. But the kinds of mitigation issues that are going on right now, the things that we're seeing in this country, this physical separation, at the same time as we're preventing an influx of cases coming in, I think that's going to go a long way to preventing us from becoming an Italy.
With more than 26,000 cases reported in the U.S., according to Johns Hopkins University's Coronavirus Resource Center, hospitals across the country are now allowing staff to reuse protective gear and masks. Five states have issued mandatory stay-at-home orders for all but essential workers.
So we took these extra steps. We've been taking them all along. My plea with folks in New Jersey is, frankly, just stay home. Unless you're essential, unless you're helping us in the fight, we need you to be at home, and we need you even at home to social distance.
And in Washington, D.C., the Senate continues to work toward a more than $1 trillion economic relief bill. This morning, Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin said the legislation includes loans to small businesses and direct payments to individuals.
Well, first of all, I hope this gets passed on Monday because we need the money now. I would say we're looking at this from anywhere to a 10 to 12 week scenario. But again, this situation is moving quickly. We need to get the money into the economy now. If we do that, we think we can stabilize the economy.
New York State now has the most confirmed cases of coronavirus infections in the country. More than half of those cases are in New York City. This morning, Mayor Bill de Blasio demanded federal help immediately.
Right now, I have asked repeatedly for the military to be mobilized. for the Defense Production Act to be used to its fullest to get us things like ventilators so people who can live who would die otherwise. Chuck, I can't be blunt enough. If the president doesn't act, people will die who could have lived otherwise.
The city's hospitals are trying to prepare, but issuing warnings of what's to come. In a letter to staff at the New York Presbyterian Hospital, the chief of surgery warned that the COVID-19 crisis is not expected to peak until mid-April and said the hospital will need 700 to 934 ICU beds and that even the lower estimates exceed our ICU capacity. Yesterday, Governor Andrew Cuomo said the state is trying to find medical equipment and supplies.
We are literally scouring the globe looking for medical supplies. We've identified 2 million N95 masks, which are the high protection masks. We have apparel companies that are converting to mask manufacturing companies in the state of New York in all sorts of creative configurations, and I want to thank them.
Worldwide, coronavirus cases steadily rose over the past 24 hours. Johns Hopkins University is tracking the pandemic and reports more than 316,000 people have the virus, and there have been more than 13,000 deaths as of this afternoon. In an interview this morning, the World Health Organization's executive director said lockdowns will not be enough to prevent the disease from resurging.
We need to actively search for cases of the virus, and we need to test every single suspect case. And if any contacts are sick, we need to test them as well. We don't need to test everybody. We need to focus on testing those who may have the virus.
Italy now has more cases than any other country. The government reported more than 53,000 cases of the virus and more than 4,800 deaths. Russia is now sending 8 mobile brigades of military medics, special disinfection vehicles, and other medical equipment to Italy. Russia has reported just 306 cases of the coronavirus and only one death. Iran turned down the United States' offer to help combat the virus there. In a televised speech, Iran's Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei called U.S. leaders, quote, charlatans and liars, and the offer of assistance strange. More than 1,600 people have died, and more than 21,000 are reportedly infected in Iran. For more on the outbreak and the latest news in the U.S. and around the world, visit pbs.org/newshour. An interactive map tracking the number of coronavirus cases globally in near real time has become an important tool for researchers, health officials, and the public at large. The dashboard was created by Johns Hopkins engineering professor Lauren Gardner and her graduate student Ensheng Dong. I recently spoke with Professor Gardner about how the interactive map works and what trends they're seeing with their research. Lauren Gardner of Johns Hopkins, thanks so much for joining us.
Hi, Hari. Thanks so much for having me.
So your site has become kind of the de facto go-to place where people find how this COVID-19 is spreading around the world. Where are you getting all that information from?
This information is coming from multiple different sources all over the world, depending on what country or region we're actually collecting the data for. And so in some parts of the world, we're getting this data in an automated fashion from local public health authorities that's being fed directly into our dashboard. In multiple areas, we're actually still collecting this through local media reports and then manually validating these data points before we enter them into the dashboard.
What have you seen? I mean, you have been watching the spread of this. I mean, most people ended up starting to pay attention to this in the United States in really February, perhaps, but you saw this spread starting in late December, January.
Yeah, absolutely. So we started the dashboard in mid-January. We've seen this outbreak grow from a local outbreak in Wuhan in China to a global pandemic that has now been reported in over 160 countries and regions around the world.
You know, there are a couple of slides that you've sent us. Sort of describe what's in one of them.
So one of the slides I sent that first looks at the global picture of what's going on is identifying the trend in cases in the countries in the top 10 countries that are reporting the most COVID cases at the moment. And one thing to note is that China is not included in that graph because there's been, at least to date, more cases in China, and they would not be shown because they'd be above the axis curve on that. But those cases have since steadied off, and there's actually not any new local reported cases coming out of China at the moment. Any cases in China are coming back actually from importations outside of China. What we're really seeing is a huge surge in cases now in multiple different countries in Europe and also in the United States. And so these are the trends that are happening. We've kind of seen this shift from east to west. And so that's what's really concerning at the moment.
And what about the 10 states in the US where it seems to be climbing faster?
So the cases are climbing in more than 10 states in the US. It's just on that one graph, we just are identifying those 10 specifically. So we're seeing a surge in cases in many states in the US because we're doing more reporting in the US. But there's a couple of things to note about this graph. One, it's showing total confirmed cases over time. So it's going to be increasing for every state no matter what, because the cases will never, obviously, the total cases will never go down. The other thing to note is that a lot of that is actually about the testing that's currently being done. And New York has taken some pretty amazing steps recently in terms of their testing capabilities. And they're actually testing a larger percentage of the population in that state than has been done even in South Korea, China, or any other state in the US. And so a big reason for that surge shown is that those are positive tests, which are only possible if you're actually doing tests.
So the more testing you're able to do, the faster your numbers are going to go up because we're just measuring confirmed cases. So is flattening the curve happening elsewhere in the world? And how likely is that in the US?
Flattening the curve is definitely happening in some places around the world. It's happened in China. We've seen it happen in South Korea. And I think it definitely can happen in the US as well. It's just should not be expected to happen tomorrow.
All right, Lauren Gardner of Johns Hopkins, thanks so much.
Thank you.
As we continue to learn more about the novel coronavirus, one thing we do know is that for seniors and those with existing medical issues, the disease caused by the virus is particularly deadly. NewsHour Weekend producer Molly Anking reports on how organizations that support New York City's seniors are responding to the coronavirus pandemic. Extra care was given to distancing measures while reporting this story.
At the 25,000 square foot City Meals on Wheels distribution center in the Bronx, dozens of volunteers and staff are packaging emergency meals. From here, they'll be delivered to homebound seniors. This is the largest meal delivery organization in the country. It's always busy, but the danger COVID-19 poses to older people is possibly the biggest challenge it's ever faced, according to Executive Director Beth Shapiro.
The people we're serving are the most vulnerable. They're vulnerable all the time, but with COVID-19, they are most susceptible, they are isolated and alone, and we need to make sure they're getting the nutrition that they need at this time.
City Meals on Wheels is New York City's designated emergency responder for seniors. That means when a disaster hits, like a hurricane or a blizzard, City Meals is responsible for feeding the homebound elderly. In the last few weeks, it has dramatically ramped up the amount of food that it's distributing.
In a given year, we're delivering 2 million meals. In just the last 2 weeks or so, we've done 250,000 meals from here.
To meet demand, Shapiro says the nonprofit has doubled its warehouse staff and arranged to buy extra food. But protecting seniors and workers from exposure to the coronavirus has added challenges. Everyone wears gloves while packing the food, but the organization has run out of masks, leaving workers to either bring their own or go without.
We are making sure our volunteers and staff are following CDC guidelines, you know, keeping a safe distance, wearing gloves, etc. Of course, nobody here if they're not feeling well. We're just making sure we do everything we can to ensure the safety of staff, volunteers, and of course, those we're delivering meals to.
City Meals has also changed how it interacts with its clients. No more in-person contact. Vivian O'Neill is the group's volunteer director.
Volunteers normally deliver meals and knock on the door, they see the seniors, sort of like a wellness check-in, you know, to see them, hand the food over to them. But because of all of this, you know, COVID-19, they're not seeing the senior, but they're hearing the senior because they're talking to them behind the door.
Hello. Hi, Miss Ross. How are you?
Besides delivering food, City Meals has a program where volunteers visit vulnerable seniors. Now, those visits are done over the phone. Hava Lawrence Challenger has been meeting with 88-year-old Harriet Ross for years.
Everything is quiet.
Okay. Are you worried when it's quiet?
I hate to be alone.
Social isolation is already a problem for millions of elderly Americans. The pandemic has made things exponentially worse, says NYU sociologist Eric Kleinenberg.
We now face a risk that everyone who's older and alone will get isolated. That will obviously protect them in some ways, but it will also compound their stress and anxiety.
Kleinenberg, who has written extensively about loneliness and aging, says the effects of isolation can directly impact a person's health.
If you're old and isolated, and especially if you get that feeling of loneliness, that compounds the experience of anxiety, of stress. It can make you feel lethargic, make you give up hope. And you get into this vicious cycle where the stress makes you more vulnerable to an illness like COVID-19.
Senior centers exist to help combat isolation among older Americans, but many have had to close their doors, including this one in Forest Hills, Queens. There's usually a daily group meal in the gym. Now, food is being prepared as to-go lunches, individually packed meals that seniors can call ahead to reserve.
Morning.
Ozzie Sevilla walked 2 blocks from his apartment to pick up lunch. He says it's an essential service right now.
It frees me up from going to the grocery store. The supermarkets, the shelves are empty anyway. So it's all good. It takes me out of the house for a little walk, and I go back in there and enjoy my lunch.
Queens Community House runs this senior center and 4 others. Ben Thomases is the executive director.
Queens Community House has always taken the position that our society needs to do much, much more to protect vulnerable people, even in ordinary circumstances.
He says the organization has had to adapt quickly and has already transitioned its English as a second language classes to online only.
What is the day? Today is Wednesday.
Those classes are going great. I mean, and you can see that the students are engaged and they're learning. And I am expecting that over time we'll also have more virtual programming for our seniors. A lot of our seniors who use our senior centers are pretty tech savvy. If we can do, you know, book groups or creative writing classes or things like that over virtually, I think it'll help a lot.
But service providers and experts acknowledge that this is likely only the beginning of what could be a long period of social isolation.
I'm worried about the problems from isolation compounding, of people becoming more isolated and more stressed and anxious over time. I suppose it's also possible that we will learn to adapt and develop some new skills for making contact in the way that we can. A lot of people are starting to use digital technology. Here we are having this interview on Zoom, but we are entering into a period where there's going to be, you know, real social pain. We are a social species. And our impulse when someone is sick is to reach out and hug them and take care of them. And we want to do that right now, but we have a very clear message that's not the right thing to do. So we're going to have to change.
As we just heard in our previous segment, there's a distinction between social distancing and social isolation. But it's not only our seniors who are impacted. And as this pandemic continues, the mental health toll will grow. I recently spoke via Zoom with Dr. Maggie Mulqueen, a psychologist who joined me from Wellesley, Massachusetts. Dr. Mulqueen, give me some examples of how COVID is affecting the mental health of the people who come to see you.
In a plethora of ways. So I think the most important distinction that we need to make is the difference between social distancing and social isolation. And I don't think that distinction is being made clearly enough to people. You know, we need to respect social distancing and hand washing as our best means right now to save ourselves physically, but we need to really shore people up against social isolation. And one part of that is that social isolation doesn't only mean being alone. There are people who are socially isolated even when they're at home with others, because there may be marital problems, or they, you know, may be feeling a rift within their family or their apartment mates or whomever. So finding ways to help people right now, to reach out, to make interconnectivity a strength, I think is essential to increasing people's resiliency to get through this from a mental health perspective.
Dr. Art, our health experts have been telling us to look out for the elderly nearby, people who can't get to the store, perhaps who are already immunocompromised. In the mental health landscape, who should we be looking out for?
Wonderful question. I think all of those people and more. No one will be untouched by this. You know, I think just like you think about the layers of who was affected by 9/11, from the people who lost their lives, to the first responders, to the family members, to the people who lived in the neighborhoods, you know, to the whole country. And I think similarly, in COVID-19, we are going to find people who are going to know this, unfortunately, at the most close and inner trauma to all of us being traumatized by it. So my hope is that if everyone can find a purpose right now, because we know that purpose is what increases our self-esteem, even in good times, if people can find a purpose, one of the best purposes we can find is to find a way to connect, even if it's with just one person. And so I would say, you know, I wouldn't actually say we should identify more this person over that person. It's who do you know in your circle that you can make some form of outreach to.
What are some of the things that concern you that will no longer be, I guess, in the public eye? I mean, if people are stuck at home, they're not going to their jobs, they're not going to schools, what are some of the things that happen inside the home that we won't have insight to?
So first of all, human touch. For those of us who are not living with others, the absence of human touch, we know, is detrimental. I mean, it's why little babies who aren't touched die. So I think anyone who is experiencing an absence of human touch is someone I'm very concerned about. I also think that without the presence of schools under these financially very difficult times, I'm very concerned in an uptick in child abuse and domestic violence. One of the things that mitigates against child abuse is that children are seen at schools. But by not seeing them at school, the belt marks, the black eyes are going to go undetected. The domestic violence is going to go undetected. So I actually am encouraging people, if they are connected to people they're concerned about, that you almost insist to, if you have the capability, of course, to do a visual interaction. We want to, you know, not just do telephone. We want to see, are there dishes piling up in the sink? Are there beds unmade? Has the person not showered in days? Are there bruises that are unexplained? So I actually think for some people, I would push towards saying, I want to see you. I want to see what your home life looks like right now, which is, I have to say, you know, was extraordinary for me this week, because as someone who never wanted to have a practice in my own home, because I like the separation between work and home, seeing my patients' homes, I was invited into their homes, which I've never seen before. And conversely, they were invited into my home. So it was a very different way to experience a therapy relationship.
And finally, doctor, this crisis has really exposed many of the shortcomings of the physical healthcare infrastructure. What are the things that you're most concerned about the mental infrastructure, the mental health infrastructure that we have in this country?
So mental health has always been the stepchild of the physical health system. Behavioral health is always short shrifted. It gets the least reimbursement from insurance. It's hard to access providers. There's much greater stigma. You know, people often talk about if their child had cancer, people would bring meals, but because their child's schizophrenic, people stay away. So there are so many factors already in our system. You know, and then if you happen to have an acting out adolescent boy, the likelihood that you're going to find a provider who can take that risk on to treat that child is much lower. So access to mental health, the reimbursement for mental health, the resources for mental health, community mental health centers, et cetera, have always been short shrifted. And now the demand is greater than ever before. You know, ironically, I think we are waiting for the P in PTSD. We want this to be post-traumatic stress disorder, but we don't know when that date is going to happen. But when it does, there, you know, we may have flattened the curve on the physical virus, but the implications of this in terms of mental health, I see going on for years to come.
Dr. Maggie McQueen, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Finally tonight, Kentucky Senator Rand Paul's office tweeted this afternoon that the senator has tested positive for COVID-19. He did not have any symptoms and is expected back in Senate after the quarantine period ends. He says he has not had any contact with any of his staff for the last 10 days. And a reminder that no matter how much our lives have been changed by the coronavirus, some things remain the same. The Northern Lights filled the skies over Finland on Friday night, right on schedule, offering us all some much-needed tranquility. That's all for this edition of PBS NewsHour Weekend. I'm Hari Srinivasan. Thanks for watching. Have a good night.
PBS NewsHour Weekend is made possible by Bernard and Irene Schwartz, Sue and Edgar Walkenheim III, the Cheryl and Philip Milstein family, Rosalind P. Walter, Barbara Hope Zuckerberg, Charles Rosenblum. We try to live in the moment to not miss what's right in front of us. At Mutual of America, we believe taking care of tomorrow can help you make the most of today. Mutual of America Financial Group, retirement services and investments. Additional support has been provided by and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and by contributions to your PBS station from viewers like you. Thank you.